Welcome to The Big Rich Show. This podcast will focus on conversations with friends and acquaintances within the four-wheel drive industry. Many of the people that I will be interviewing, you may know the name, you may know some of the history, but let's get in depth with these people and find out what truly makes them a four-wheel drive enthusiast. So now's the time to sit back, grab a cold one, and enjoy our conversation.
Whether you're crawling the Red Rocks of Moab or hauling your toys to the trail, Maxxis has the tires you can trust for performance and durability. Four wheels or two, Maxxis tires are the choice of champions because they know that whether for work or play, for fun or competition, Maxxis tires deliver. Choose Maxxis. Tread victoriously.
Why should you read Four Low Magazine? Because Four Low Magazine is about your lifestyle, the four-wheel drive adventure lifestyle that we all enjoy. Rock crawling, trail riding, event coverage, vehicle builds, and do-it-yourself tech all in a beautifully presented package. You won't find Four Low on the newsstand rack, so subscribe today and have it delivered to you. On today's episode of Conversations with Big Rich, we have Ian Liljeblad.
Hey,
I know
Rich,
I just fucked that up. All right. Go ahead. And Ian, thank you for coming on board. Started that one off right away bad. Go ahead and pronounce your name again for all the listeners.
It's Liljeblad.
Liljeblad. Okay.
Yep.
I know I've said it right a number of times before I went to do the intro, but I knew as soon as I started the intro I was going to screw it up. But anyway, thank you for coming on board. And, you know, we want to talk to you today about your history in off-road. And I guess the best place to start is, you know, where did you grow up?
Well, I was born in Flint, Michigan, moved to Arizona, Phoenix, with my mom when I was about four. So basically grew up my whole life in Phoenix. Shortly after moving to Phoenix, my mom met my stepdad and we moved into Scottsdale. So I spent basically my whole childhood in Scottsdale, Arizona.
Scottsdale's a nice place. It's over the years it's grown quite a bit. I remember when there were no loop highways to get anywhere, yeah. You had to go down Bell or Thunderbird.
Yeah, so you've spent some time in Arizona then, huh?
Yeah, my sister moved there in the 80s.
Okay.
And still lives in the house that they bought back or had built back then. And yeah, my nephew and niece grew up there. But we used to go visit when I lived in Cedar City. We'd go down there for Christmas because it was nice and warm and Cedar City was not.
Right. Yeah, it's beautiful in the winter here, that's for sure.
So growing up in Arizona, off-road was probably pretty common for you. Was that correct? Even if it was bicycles or whatever, I mean, you probably lived right on the edge of the desert.
Yeah, we did. We lived in kind of a little rural spot of Scottsdale. Like I said, my mom married, his name is David Ellis, and his family was one of the first to settle in Scottsdale. So yeah, we lived on 2.5 acres and I had a couple of stepbrothers and, you know, it was always BMX bikes and go-karts and motorcycles and that kind of stuff. My stepdad he's not around anymore. He died in a plane crash actually, but he was a big influence on my mechanical skills and fabrication. He was a builder of many things. Built fiberglass flat bottom boats for a while. Built the first ever fiberglass water slide.
Wow.
Later in life was a general contractor and built homes. In the late 60s, he was on the pit crew for Mario Andretti and built the winning body for Andretti in the the 1969 Indianapolis 500.
Wow, that's a piece of history right there.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. He came up with the first ever attempt at the front wing on an Indy car.
Wow.
So at that time, it was just two little kind of scoops on the side of the nose that, pushed the front end of the car down just a little bit. And that was enough traction for Andretti to go just a little bit faster than everybody else. David told me at one time that the next race, I don't recall which race that was, but he said the next race, every car in the lineup had those little wings on the side.
there's no better flattery than being copied.
Right.
Yep.
Right.
Well, that's,
he was an innovator.
That's awesome. And you were born in, what I read, 75, somewhere around there?
73.
Okay.
Yeah.
So then how did, when you were in high school, did you play any organized sports? I know many of us did a little bit, but it wasn't like a big focus. What was your focus in school?
No, I didn't play any organized sports really at all. I was on a little league team, in, I don't know, fourth or fifth grade. But other than that, no, I don't know, for whatever reason, I just never had an interest in it. My dad was quite an athlete when he was a kid, but I don't know, for whatever reason, I just didn't have interest in it.
That's cool. Did you do scouting or anything like that, or was it just, hanging out in the desert?
Yeah, I did Boy Scouts too, not for very long, but it was more like riding BMX bikes and building forts and exploring the canal. They'd empty the SRP canal, and we'd go down in there and catch crawdads and stuff like that.
That's awesome.
It was more like exploring kind of stuff.
Awesome. So that kind of gets us to where some of the things that you're doing now, it makes sense. What was the first vehicle that you drove besides a go-kart?
So my mom, when she drove out to Arizona, moved to Arizona with me, her parents gave her a 78 Impala. Green 78 Impala.
A beautiful green too.
Yeah, a beautiful green, and not a beautiful car to start with either. And then, she held onto that car all those years, and that became my first car. And
a chick magnet.
Yeah. it was a lot of fun. To tell you the truth, I got held back in first grade, so I was a year older than all my friends in high school, and so I was the first to drive, and we would all pile in that thing, and whenever it rained, we'd go hit the slick parking lots and do donuts, and we had a lot of fun in that car.
I can tell you. The Impalas, when I was growing up, my best friend's dad had a 63 Impala, and it was a two-door, and we would take it up to the high school parking lot and do the same thing and do burnouts and everything. And I can remember dropping the rear end in the parking lot of the high school at like 11 o'clock at night, just blowing the rear end up in it. And it was like, oh, shit, now what do we do? You know what I mean? We knew we were in trouble. there was burnout marks all through the parking lot. Not all of them were ours, but by the time the cops showed up and we were stuck there with the rear end all over the parking lot, yeah, we caught a lot of flack for that one.
That's hilarious.
That's what's cool about talking with these interviews, mm-hmm. is that it brings back memories for things that happened to me that I've completely forgotten about. You know, it just triggers that. Oh yeah, this happened. So
right.
I gotta thank everybody that we've interviewed so far. I don't know. I'm up to almost 50 now. So.
Oh wow. Nice.
Yeah. So thank you for bringing back that memory. It was a good memory.
Sure.
So with that chick magnet, and I know you could pack a lot of people into it.
Sure.
Tell us some of the shenanigans you got into, besides burnouts on the slick parking lots. Anything else?
Well, like I said, we were in this, like I said, this rural kind of area of Scottsdale, and right butting up next to Paradise Valley, which is Paradise Valley's minimum 1 acre lots. So I had friends that lived in those neighborhoods, and we had some, we called them tracks. So we had some tracks around the neighborhood that, you know, we would hit at, you know, 1 or 2 a.m. in the, we called the Impala the bucket.
The bucket.
And, you know, these tracks are going through kind of alleys and backyards of other people's houses. So it was like you run through it one time and you call it a night because you're not going to go through twice and get caught.
Yeah.
And eventually I got some other vehicles after that, and then that Impala sat for a couple years, and eventually we cut it all up and cut the roof off of it and took the trunk lid off and put a seat back there and drove it out into North Scottsdale, where, you know, where there's plenty of houses now, but back then there was nothing. And we ended up jumping it into in and out of a big wash. And then once it wouldn't run anymore, lit it on fire.
So if there's any Scottsdale officers listening, that old Impala that you found, that was not the one, right?
Yeah, right. I can't believe that. It never came back on me. Like, it's unbelievable, really.
You did a good job of burning it down then.
I guess. I mean, we left the car there and we were driving out and driving south, or I'm sorry, west back on Shea Boulevard towards Scottsdale. And there were fire trucks, you know, coming up Shea going towards it. And, you know, we knew where they were going. And I don't know. Nothing ever came of it, though,
wow.
Surprisingly.
Yeah, that is surprisingly. I would imagine for a week or two you were sweating it.
Yeah, yeah, a little bit. And we got it all on video, too. And it's uploaded onto YouTube now, actually.
That's great. That's great. At least it didn't turn out like those guys that had that Baja Bug, that Class 5 car that they...
Oh, yeah.
That they burned all around down there in San Diego or wherever it was at, and ended up with all sorts of lawsuits and troubles over that thing.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool to do shit like that. But so,
yeah.
So let's move forward a little bit. And where did the off-roading really get started? What'd you get started in? What was your first four-wheel drive?
It was a 74 CJ5. And really how I got into that CJ5 was after the Impala, I had a 91 or 92 Nissan hardbody.
Okay.
That was a two wheel drive truck, but I lifted it and put a little bigger tire on it and had a big stereo in it and stuff. I ended up selling that. And then, a friend of mine was into street bikes, and he had a CBR 600. So I sold that Nissan truck and got a CBR 600 and crashed that. I think it must have been just weeks after I got it.
That's pretty typical. That's why they kept selling so many of those Rice Rockets.
Right. So yeah, I crashed on the freeway.
Ouch.
Doing like 80 miles an hour. I grabbed too much of front brake and it just washed out. And so I broke my hand at that point and had a bunch of road rash. Got the bike back together and was riding it a couple weeks later with a broken hand and wasn't looking where I was going and rear-ended a van and flew over that van. I'm lucky to be alive, truthfully, in both of those occasions.
It sounds like it.
Yeah. Broke my ankle somehow flying over that van. And then, you know, then I got some threats from my parents about getting back on a motorcycle. And, you know, I think I was over 18 at that point, but, you know, I think it clicked with me and I realized that I needed something with a roll cage.
Some of us learn earlier than others.
Yeah, I'm sure. So then, you know, I got some insurance money from the bike. It was totaled. And, I almost bought a Scout. I don't really even know Scouts that well to even tell you what model it was, but it was one of the smaller ones that was full convertible. But anyway, that sale didn't go through and I remember being so disappointed about it. But now looking back, I found the 74 CJ5 and I'm really happy I'm a Jeep guy, not a Scout guy.
Yeah, you'd have been ruined for life.
Right?
Scout guys are worse than Toyota guys. See, I could say all this because I am not brand specific.
Right?
I mean, yeah. I own a Toyota. I've owned every kind of pickup truck you could think of, including an International. And, you know, it's just, it doesn't matter to me as long as I can get it where it can get me where I want to go.
Sure. Yeah. No, I agree with trucks as well. I'm not brand specific at all.
Although I am enjoying my Ford Raptor.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So what'd you do to the five? Was it all stock when you got it?
It was pretty much stock. I mean, it had a little bit of a lift kit on it, I think. Maybe like a 2.5-inch kit and some 31s or something maybe. Then I just started tinkering with it in the garage and started reading magazines and, you know, learning about all these guys in Phoenix in this Jeep think tank. And eventually met Randy Ellis at the Arizona State Association of Four-Wheel Drive Clubs run, which is was in March or April.
Right.
It's not around anymore, obviously. But anyway, I saw Randy in magazines and recognized him at the event and approached him. And by this time, I had already done a spring over in the front with some YJ springs and a reverse shackle, you know, introduced myself to him and showed him what I'd been doing to the Jeep. And we just kind of seemed to hit it off. And he started inviting me out to go wheeling with him and Shannon and Mike Flores and, you know, all those guys.
Right.
And then I guess Randy was impressed enough with my work, even though I was amateurish at that point, or maybe it was my drive. I don't know. But Randy was working at FST at that point, which was Flying High's fab shop.
Right.
And offered me a job over there. I think I was working at Discount Tire at that point. So, you know, for that opportunity, I immediately quit Discount and went over there and worked with him. And Jeff Geiser worked at FST at that point.
Wow, all so, the movers and shakers.
Yeah, yeah. Jeff was a big influence on my fabrication very early on, as well as Randy, obviously.
Huh, interesting.
Yeah.
So how long did you work there?
I think I was at FST for a year and a half or 2 years, maybe.
Okay.
And then Randy got hired by Four Wheeler Supply. And so he left FST, told me that he would hire me at Four Wheelers. He got hired to run or to start. I guess they had a fab shop already, but it was mostly just their class 8 kind of prep shop. It wasn't really open for customer custom work or whatever. So they hired Randy to open that side of it to do the custom work for customers. And anyway, he told me, you know, as soon as I, you know, get busy enough or have the room for you over there, I'll bring you over. So I think I stayed at FST for another 6 months or something. And then he hired me over there. And I worked at Wheelers for, I think, about 7 or 8 years.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. I kind of went on and off with, well, I left Four Wheelers and worked for another little, just little welding shop in Scottsdale. It was a friend of mine called DCS Welding. And worked with him for a while. Couple years, and then I went back to Four Wheelers for another year or something like that when Rob Bonney was running the shop at that point.
Okay.
I kind of missed my opportunity to run the fab shop at Four Wheelers because I had left. You know, Randy was still running the shop, and then Randy left to go out on his own while I was at DCS Welding, and Rob was working. Or Rob got hired after I left. So I guess it's neither here nor there, but I've thought about it occasionally over the years. Like if I had stayed, I would have been running, probably I would have been running the shop at Four Wheelers, but it is what it is. And I guess I'm not unhappy with the way everything's turned out. Just crosses my mind.
We all have those what if moments, right? You know, when you look back and say, wow, if that would have worked out differently, what would have happened? And then I look at where my life has taken me and I'm like, it didn't need to happen the way it could have. It needed to happen the way it did. So
yeah, I'm absolutely true. I feel the same way.
Yeah. No regrets, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
So then, I know that there's a couple of things that are more in your life that have happened recently that I want to delve into, but I think those need to be, I think we need to set up how those things happened, and it's the Big Willies and then the Go Devil. So those came later, but it was fab skills that you learned along the way, with Randy and then at Four Wheelers and that kind of stuff. So, where did you go from there that ended up getting you to influencing you to create a 2-to-1?
Well, so after Four Wheelers, I started my own business. I went out on my own and started RPM Fab or RPM Fabrication. And the way I did that was I would build a Jeep for myself. Starting out at Four Wheelers, obviously they were nice enough. Brian Christensen ran Four Wheelers at that point, and he was nice enough to let me build. I built a 2x4 rectangle tube chassis CJ7 there, which was my first chassis for myself anyway.
Okay.
And, you know, that thing was, like I said, custom chassis, CJ7, ZZ4, Turbo 400, Model 20 transfer case, semi-float Dana 60 rear, 44 in the front, 35-inch boggers. This was like...
the boggers.
yeah. This was like 96 or 97, I believe. So anyway, getting back to my business, I started building Jeeps like that, and I would sell them. And then take that cash and build another one. And you know, after a while I had some capital built up and saved up, and figured I had enough to buy an iron worker and a few other things, and went out on my own. So I owned that business for about 10 years from 03 to 2013.
Okay.
It went really well. I mean, I made a living, but, I mean, I don't really think that there's a whole lot of money in fabrication unless I guess some guys know how to do it really well and have made a quite a profitable business out of it. But I think I'm a better fabricator than a businessman.
As most of our industry is.
Yeah, sure.
There's guys that are creating incredible works of art or products that, you know, are well advancing the sport.
Mm-hmm.
But very few of them are able to turn that into a business that is well run and profitable.
Yeah.
It's more like a hobby shop that just barely pays for itself, or they get end up with a part-time job somewhere along the way. So, you know, I understand that.
Yeah, that's basically how it was. You know, I just barely squeaked by, and there were many times where I thought I'm just going to have to close the shop and, you know, do something else. But I was always able to make it work and make it survive. And then, so in 2011, I went to Burning Man for the first time. I had seen images on the internet, specifically of this sculpture called the Big Rig Jig, which is basically two semi-trucks, tanker trucks, that are put together in this kind of S shape, like standing upright. Wow. So there's basically like a semi-truck cab and chassis with a tanker trailer all twisted up and like floating in the air. And now it was an art installation at Burning Man, I think in 2008. But if anybody Google searches Big Rig Jig, it'll come right up, or Big Rig Jig Burning Man.
Okay.
And that was the image that I saw and was like, I have to go to this place. And it was what really inspired me. So at that point, you know, that was probably in 08 or 09 or 10 or something. And I was talking to my friends, trying to get them convinced that they need to go, so I'd have somebody to go with. And none of my friends were really interested in it for some reason. And I had a girlfriend at the time of 8 years, and she was interested in it. But we put it off for a few years for whatever reason. And then she surprised me in 2011 and just bought tickets. At that time, you could just buy tickets. It burnt. 2011 was the first year that Burning Man sold out. So she was able to buy tickets before it sold out without an issue, and surprised me with those. And we went. And we didn't know anybody that was going, and we didn't know anybody that had ever been. And Burning Man changed my life.
Yeah, I read that in a post that you did somewhere.
Yeah. That's interesting that you saw that. Yeah. It's I can't explain what it's like. I could we could talk about it every day for a year, and you could watch every YouTube video about it. And if you went with me this year, halfway through the week, you'd turn to me and say, why didn't you tell me it was like this? It's it's indescribable. I would suggest that anybody who has any interest in it at all should go. And just once, you know, if it's not for you after that, then I totally get it.
That's interesting. I've heard that from a couple of others that have gone, or that go now all the that continue to go.
Anybody in the off-road world, or
no,
Okay.
Now, not you're the only one in the off-road world that I know that has continued to go. I can't remember who it was, but there was somebody that had gone, and they were out of the Reno area, I think, and they had gone, and they said that it was a wild, trippy party, and that's about all they could remember from it. Because they went there with the idea of just getting totally plowed.
Right. I was going to say, was that Harry Wagner? But that doesn't sound like Harry Wagner.
No, it's not Harry.
Harry's gone, and I guess he didn't camp with me that year, but spent a lot of time with me. I think that was in 2018.
Okay.
But anyway, once I went to Burning Man, I kind of lost interest in the four-wheel drive thing. I ended up building an art car, or a mutant vehicle, as burners call them, for 2012. So it was when I was there in 2011 on Playa, or at the event, I still am a big reggae fan,
right?
Which is something that Eric Villar introduced me to. So, and I thought, you know, this is a festival or an event that originated in San Francisco on the beach. And, you know, Northern California has a pretty big reggae scene. So I thought, you know, oh, there's got to be reggae music at Burning Man. Even though it's not a music festival, I figured there'd be a camp or, you know, a live music camp that might have a reggae band or something. But I couldn't find anything. So I decided, you know, while I was there that first year, that I'm going to build an art car and reggae music is going to be my gift.
Cool.
So I built this double-decker kind of party bus, all reggae themed, so red, green, and yellow. And it has a big lion head on the front. A lion head made out of metal.
Right, not painted. I mean, not a painted head, but a fabbed head.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's made out of this quarter-inch wire frame, and then I sheeted it with some perforated that I cut out on the plasma table. I cut out these Burning Man logos out of, I think I used 5 or 6 4x10 sheets.
Wow.
And these logos are only, you know, 2 inches tall or something. So it's thousands of them. And then, I used the logos that dropped out as gifts to put on lanyards or necklaces to hand out. And then I used this leftover sheet, or the negative of that, as the perforated for the skin of the lion head.
Sweet.
So, like I said, reggae was my gift. And, so then I brought that in 2012, and, it was a huge hit. I mean, people were flocking to it to get away from the common music that's there, which is like EDM or house music.
Okay.
So they would come to find us to get away in the afternoon and have a more of a chill kind of vibe and listen to reggae and whatever, have fun. So anyway, then that's what I did for Burning Man for the next, 8 years or so.
Wow. Okay.
So yeah, that car has been to Burning Man 9 times. No, 8 times. Sorry. And, Eric Villar had a stock flat fender for quite a few years.
Right.
and got it during this period where I was going to Burning Man, and I had sold all my off-road stuff. I'll back up a little bit. I sold my business in 2013. I owned two houses at that point. I had a rental and then my primary residence. I sold both of those and sold all my off-road toys so I could have capital to flip houses.
Okay.
And flipped for a few years, maybe three. Wasn't entirely too successful with it. I mean, I made some money, but for the time and effort that I put in, just wasn't something I wanted to do anymore. I got my real estate license in 2013, basically so I could just save on commissions. And then I started concentrating more on just being an agent. And like I said, during this time, Eric Fillard had gotten his Stalker flat fender. And I didn't really get it early on when he first got it. You know, I thought it was cool, but, you know, it didn't really click with me at that point.
Right.
And then I ended up buying one like 2016.
Okay.
I got a 48 CJ2A. For whatever reason, I got inspired and bought one. And it needed basically everything gone through: motor, training, transfer case. Did all that and then started going wheeling with Eric and just fell in love with these flat fenders. I'd never had more fun in a Jeep than in a Stalker like that.
Not just wheeling them, but also repairing them and keeping them going.
Yeah, for sure. Through that time I was still going to Burning Man, and there's a group here in Phoenix, or Scottsdale actually. It's called Walter Productions, which is, they started out with Walter the bus, which is a giant VW bus. I'm not sure if you've ever seen it or run across it.
No, I have not.
Okay. Well, it's a VW bus built on a airport crash truck chassis.
Okay.
So they basically just took the whole body off and fabricated a VW bus, you know, replica, but I don't know what the scale of theirs is. I imagine it's about 1.5 or 1.75 to 1.
Okay.
But it's huge. I mean, it's 14 feet tall. And that, again, if anybody Googles Walter the bus, it'll come right up. So anyway, I had camped with them a few years, and they built a Beetle a couple years later after the bus, and that one's called Big Red. And so I was kind of inspired by this, building something in scale or in a larger scale by Walter and their leader, or the brainchild behind Walter is a guy named Kirk Strawn. So he's become a good friend over the years, and then I just thought, well, why not apply this concept to flat fender and build another art car for Burning Man? And you know, I talked about it for a couple of years, talked a lot about it with Eric, and I just decided I'm going to do it, and put together a proposal, a 9-page or 10-page proposal, to try and appeal to some of the off-road parts companies that might be interested to get some help with it, some sponsorship. And I built Big Willie in 7 months.
Wow. That's pretty good. Yeah.
It was a crazy 7 months. I never took a day off, except it took about 3 or 4 days and went to Moab for Jeep Safari just to try and hit up some of the vendors there with my proposal. And I had built the grill at that point, stamped my own grill. So I was walking around with the grill at the arena there, trying to use it as a prop to get some attention and talk to some of these guys, which ended up working. I got a few sponsors on that trip.
Well, if they saw the workmanship that you put into the grill, that would make sense. I mean, there's no better way to present something than actually, you know, showing part of it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It was a good trip. I ended up talking with Steve at Off-Road Design, and he helped me out with a Magnum box and twin stick for the 205, and really helped me out a lot. Great guy, great product.
And so he's really involved or started Full Size Invasion too, didn't he?
Yeah. So yeah, he did.
Makes sense, because that flat fender is no longer, I mean, it's definitely considered full size.
Yeah. The original plan was for me to do the full size run in Moab with him. But it just turned out later that it just wasn't practical to really wheel Big Willie that hard.
Right.
I think I would have just blown up axle shafts doing that kind of stuff. You know, it gets wheeled lightly, but not really like any kind of heavy duty rock crawling or anything like that.
Right. So let's talk about the process of building Big Willie, and how you went around building a 2-to-1 car, a replica that, you know, I mean, it's amazing when I look at it. At first, I was like, when I first time I saw it, it was like, I looked at it. And then, to be honest, I was like, why? You know, I mean, if just to be plain and simple, I was like, why? And yeah. And then over the course of a couple of years, where I've seen it different places and watching people look at it and the amazement that everybody has on it, I get it. You know, I'm not a fabricator, so there's no way I could have done it. And that's probably why I said why, but I should have looked at it more from a marketing standpoint, and then I would have understood it better to begin with.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, that's a common response, especially on the internet.
Right.
you get those guys that just want to
bash, you know, everything.
Talk bad about it or bash it or whatever.
Yeah.
And usually I just try and kill those guys with kindness.
There you go.
But so, yeah, when I first started building it, I didn't really know how I was going to build the body. I guess I didn't know the technique that I was going to use. But I thought that I could figure it out along the way. It's kind of how I work, really. You know, I don't know how many cars I've built from scratch over the years, but I've never, like, you know, used SolidWorks or, you know, CAD or anything like that to draw anything up prior. It's just like, usually it's a hand-drawn sketch with, you know, a wheelbase that I know I'm going to start with, and you know, a general kind of sketch of the look that I want. So, like I said, I didn't know how I was going to do it, but I thought I would be able to figure it out. And luckily, I have a friend that is really talented with SolidWorks, and was willing to help me. So he came to the shop and we took measurements off of my CJ2A, and he basically drew the whole body in SolidWorks. And then, you know, you lay those parts out flat in SolidWorks and convert them to a DXF. And I cut them all out on the plasma table and put it all together like a big puzzle.
So is it, what material did you use? Just a sheet metal?
Yeah, it was 18 gauge for the body panels. And then there's a framework of the body out of like quarter inch strap, basically.
Okay.
That was all cut. That was all cut on the plasma table as well, and then formed with a roller for the corners and that sort of thing. And I was amazed at how well everything went together using SolidWorks and just cutting those parts out on the plasma table. It was like, within a 16th of an inch, tolerances all the way around. Things fit together just perfect.
Wow. That's pretty damn good. I can't even do that with anything.
I know. I was sincerely amazed. It went together quite nicely. And the chassis is a 3x6 rectangle tube, 120 wall, which was cut on the plasma table as well. Like cut pie shapes out and just bent the tube together and welded it.
Wow. Okay.
I was able to do that on the plasma table myself instead of sending it to a laser tube cutter. And, I don't know. Where else do you want to go?
Seven months, huh? That's.
Yeah. 7 months. I mean, the goal was to get it done. I started in late January, early February. And the goal was to get it done for Burning Man that year, which is late August, early September. So I think I put it on the trailer like August 20th or 22nd or something like that. And, you know, just like any other build, working on it to the very last second before it goes on the trailer.
Right.
But I got it there. It didn't have paint or powder coat or anything. I ran out of time to do all that, but it was running and driving, and the Burning Man DMV accepted it as a mutant vehicle licensed on Playa. So the whole goal worked in the end.
That's amazing that you say the Burning Man DMV. So every one of the vehicles has to be approved?
Yeah, and there's a pre-approval process. So you have to fill out an application. It's an online application. You submit either pictures or renderings or drawings if you don't have it built yet. And then you get, if they approve it, or if they like the idea anyway, then they send you an invitation. So, but that's just an invitation to bring it. It's not a guarantee that you will get a license.
Okay.
So then once you get it there, you go to the DMV. Usually it's prior to the event. They give me early entry because I have the other car, Movement of Jah People. And, so they usually give art car, guys and, you know, we got people who do art installations, they'll give them, early entry so you can get there and get things set up and ready to go.
So you're not trying to do that during the masses or while the masses are there.
Right. Exactly. So anyway, then usually you try and get in line at the DMV, prior to the event on Saturday or Sunday. And there's an inspection process. But what's surprising about the inspection process is that there's no, like, they're not really looking at safety stuff. They're not, they, it's not like they have a clipboard and they're looking for fire extinguishers and first aid kits. All they're looking at is if it's art.
Okay.
So any part of the donor vehicle, like Big Willie is, doesn't have a donor vehicle, but any part of my, like my other car, which was a Class C motorhome, 78 Class C. At one point, I think it was the first year, actually, I didn't have the front fenders covered. So they wanted something to cover those.
So it didn't original, look like the like it came from a motorhome.
Yeah, exactly. It's like any of that original sheet metal. That was really the only original sheet metal that was left on it. But they wanted me to cover it, whether it was just, you know, some fabric or something. So, you know, we figured something out, improvised, and covered it. So I was concerned that Big Willie wasn't, that they weren't going to approve it, because it's not, I mean, I guess it's art in some way, but it's not really artistic. It's just
a replica.
A large scale replica. But I had the whole Walter Productions, their history at Burning Man on my side. So if they were going to dispute it in any way, I had an argument that, well, you have this VW bus and this VW bug that are essentially the same thing, just a different vehicle. But anyway, they didn't give me a hard time about it. And it was licensed. And so Big Willie has been to Burning Man twice now.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So let's get into the Go Devil.
Oh yeah.
And the rest of your history with flat fenders. Thanks to Eric Fillar.
Yeah. Yeah, and then I think Eric Fillar could thank Drew Barber.
Yep.
For getting him into it. I'm sure you know who Drew is, and
yes,
the whole thing at Avalanche and whatever. So anyway, I just really started getting into this whole flat fender thing with Eric, and we'd go wheeling. We went and ran the Rubicon a couple years in a row. Just he and I 1 year, and then the next year was he and I and another friend of mine that had a Stalker. And I don't know, I just really enjoyed wheeling those things and, you know, driving into the springs there and have some guy driving a JK and, you know, look over at us and say, how did you get that here? I mean, that's literally happened, you know, 5-6 times where people just can't believe that you drove it there. And so that, you know, that's part of the inspiration, you know, taking something stock like that and making people think, you know. So then the whole Go Devil thing, I don't know, I thought about doing that sort of event for maybe a year or so and just kicking around the idea. Then I just decided, well, all right, I'm going to do it. I just made a Facebook group, you know, kicked around ideas with Eric about where we should go, what we should do. And we ended up with 21 flat fenders for the first year. It was May 1st of 2020. Yeah. And I was, truthfully, I was expecting about 5 cars to show up. And I mean, I would have been happy with 5. But we got 21 to show up, and one came all the way from Florida.
Trailered.
Yeah. Okay.
That would have been a long drive.
Yeah, that would have been a long drive in the flat fender. But yeah, I mean, he drove 2,200 miles. And anyway, we our route was the back way up to Crown King, you know, from Lake Pleasant to Crown King. We ended up camping in one spot for the whole weekend. So we went up Friday morning, got a camp spot near Crown King. Saturday we spent just kind of playing around in the area, Crown King and Horse Thief Basin, just exploring around there. It's kind of a milder day from Friday because Friday was a long day. We did about 30 miles. Some pretty rough stuff. I mean, for a flat fender anyway.
Exactly.
A lot. It was warm. It was about 10 degrees above normal. So it was in the 90s. So we had a lot of vapor lock issues.
A lot of melted ice.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of melted ice for sure. But that, you know, that in turn makes for a lot of beer stops.
Barley pops. Yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's really the part that I look forward to the most in those kind of events is, you know, the stop and hang out, socializing.
And that's what I liked about the idea of the Go Devil Run, as opposed to some of the other flat fender or original Willys type runs, is that you guys are doing it more off-road and not making mm-hmm. long travel plans, like, you know, 1,100 miles or 1,000 miles across pavement and dirt roads, where it's more, I don't know, it's more like the event is about getting there than it is about the trip there.
Yeah, right.
I don't know if that yeah. makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does.
Okay.
Yeah, the whole idea, I mean, we did, last year we did, I think, 160 or 165 miles in the dirt. And the whole idea, really, I guess I should have said this first, but the whole idea of the Go Devil Run is that, for one, you should have a Go Devil motor, which is the L134, the flathead that they came with.
Right.
And the second thing is that they should look like they should look like they came out of the 1940s or 1950s. Like those old videos you see on the Rubicon Trail.
Right. No white spoke Jackman wheels or.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. So part of the rules is that it must be a bi-ply tire, no bigger than 30 and a half tall, no modern wheels. And it's just basically like if you took a picture at any point on the run and in black and white, you may not be able to tell if it's modern day or if it's, you know, 1940s. So we try and dress the part, you know, try and find vintage clothing and, you know, make it as authentic as possible, paying tribute to those guys that came before us, you know, a lot of veterans that came back from the war, from World War II and bought flat fenders because they drove them in the war and loved them, used them on ranches and that sort of thing. So it's a tribute to them.
Right. And I thought it, you guys did really well with that. Ryan Miller put together, Ryan and Kaylee put together an article for Four Low magazine for us. On it, and the pictures were all in black and white, and the settings, and it really did look like, except that the photography was so much cleaner and clearer than the images from back then.
Right.
You know, if it had been in the 50s, that, you know, that was the only way to tell is, you know, the resolution was a lot better. But,
yeah.
But it was awesome. I mean, I love that aspect of it.
I think I'm on the cover, aren't I?
I think you are.
I never got a copy of that, actually.
You didn't? Oh, okay.
I don't know if you have any laying around or if they're still able to purchase, but let me know.
All right. I'll do that. So are the plans to do it again this year?
Yeah. So yeah, we're all scheduled for the same weekend. It's the first weekend in May is what we're shooting for every year. This year we're up to about 31 or 32, I believe.
Wow.
Yeah. The goal was to stick at 30. I think we're going to be 31 or 32, maybe.
It's really hard to tell people no. You yeah. know, because everybody wants to work toward it to make it, you know, their vehicle to do it, first of all. And it's not like right. you're just going to take one that you find sitting in some guy's barn and go drive it 168 miles. You know, it's just yeah. realistically, right. it just ain't going to work that way. So, you know that people are putting the effort into it. It's one of the things that when we eventually quit doing events and I have some time and have a shop, I want to build. I used to have a 53 M38A1, the original, you know, military five. And
yeah.
I love that vehicle, except that it wasn't all original. It had a SM465 in it, an Oddfire V6, but otherwise it was, you wouldn't have known. And it, you know, it right. still had the manual steering, 31 inch tires, and I loved that Jeep. And I want to do the same thing, but with a flat fender. I owned a 48 CJ2A, but it had the V8, the little Buick V8, the 215.
Oh, yeah. It
became the 3.8 or whatever it is that they sold to Rover. And,
uh-huh.
It had one of those in it. So it scooted really well in the sand dunes, but it was it was crazy doing 65 miles an hour in the sand dunes with just a B-pillar bar and no windshield.
Yeah, I bet. I bet.
I should have died.
I know, I shouldn't be here either.
So what are the plans for the future?
Well, I started a little business centered around these flat fenders just in the past. I guess it hasn't even really been a year yet. It kind of just took off when COVID started. I started making parts for the stocker flat fender crowd. So I make some rock sliders and U-bolt skid plates and quite a bit of upholstery stuff. So replacement seat covers and cushions.
Wow.
Go ahead.
No, I was to say, and what's that called?
The website is Big Willy Jeep.
Okay.
So I basically just, you know, I took the Big Willy Jeep website and just put a shop page on it. And I just call it, it's the business name is Big Willy Jeep Parts. So, yeah, that's been going really well. It just started as the upholstery stuff. And then, you know, I had already made some rock sliders before, so I put those on the store, and I've just been trying to add, you know, products, trying to add one once a month at least and, grow that business. But, you know, there's no storefront. I don't really even have a shop. I share a shop with a friend of mine. It lives out in Queen Creek. When RPM went out of business, I bought back most of my equipment from them and put that at this friend of mine's shop in Queen Creek. But most of my metal parts I have laser cut and formed. And then I just go pick those up and weld them together if they need welding, or just box them up if they're a do-it-yourself kit. And ship them out. So
nice.
Trying to keep it real simple. I don't have any employees. It's just a one man show. So I guess the plan is to, you know, grow that business. Hopefully not grow it so big where I need employees, but we'll see how that goes.
Right.
And I still have my real estate license. But I don't really market myself as a realtor. I just kind of do referral and friends and family. And, but the long-term goal is to, trying to buy and hold residential real estate at this point. So trying to acquire rental properties.
Right. That's not a bad idea.
Yeah. You know, it's something that I kicked around for 20 years now. And I got into the flipping thing, and at that point I should have just started. I should have kept the two houses that I had and turned them into rentals and gone that direction. But I had a friend who was flipping. It was doing really well. I got inspired by him, but you know, that's one of those coulda, woulda, shoulda things we were talking about earlier, or what ifs. So it is what it is.
Right. Now we flipped a couple, and then we've got three rentals, plus we own a small boutique hotel in Mason, Texas, where there's two off-road parks. And so it works out really well for us.
That's great.
Yeah. I don't know if I want to do too many more fixer-uppers, you might say.
As far as flip, you mean?
Shelly, exactly. Shelly just looked at me like, what? She's over here. She's over here working on the magazine, doing some editing and putting things together for the next issue. And when I said that, I saw her look over at me like, what?
Yeah.
That's one of her things. We'll be driving down the road and I'll look at something. There'll be no windows in it. It's obviously not been lived in like 40 or 50 years. You know, it's slightly leaning to one side, and I'll look at her and go, hey, there's a fixer upper for you.
Right. But, yeah. It's hard to find deals now on flips.
Everybody's doing it.
Yeah, everybody's doing it, and it's, you know, it's 6 to 8 weeks of really tough labor, and if you don't buy it right, you're not going to make money.
Correct.
It's tough.
And I think it's not all the good stuff, but a lot of the good stuff in the right neighborhoods at the right price, everybody realizes what they've got now.
Oh yeah.
You know, don't lowball me, you know, that old saying, don't lowball me, I know what I got. Type yep. thing, you know, unless you can find them in auction, you know, in repos or something like that. And then we did that one time, or we've done that a couple of times. And one time we got into the house, when I finally got there to look at it, was in North Carolina, and there was no copper in the house. They'd taken, people had gone in there and broken windows and ripped out all the appliances that had been left. And it was like, all right, let's, this one's going to be a tough one. And then we had a real estate agent come in and offer to buy it at a profit for us without even us having to do a thing. So,
those are the best deals.
Yeah. So we said, yeah, we'll take that.
Yeah, totally. Those are the best deals ever.
Yes. We bought an apartment one time. It was part of an apartment complex, and it was like, I think it was a total of 16 units, and we bought one of eight on one side. And there was somebody that owned like eight across on the other eight, uh-huh. on the other side of the complex. And then somebody had bought two or three that in the same building as us. And they looked at us and they were like, well, what are you going to do with yours? I said, we're going to rent it out. And they were like, oh, really? Okay. Because they wanted to do, you know, they had this whole condo type thing in their mind. And all done was clean it and painted it. We hadn't done flooring yet. We hadn't done appliances or anything. And we sold that one. I mean, we only owned it for like maybe 3 weeks. And we turned that one over for a profit. So it was like, yes.
Yeah.
But that doesn't happen very often.
No, it doesn't. But when it does,
it's nice. Man,
yeah.
Well, cool. Is there anything that you've got that you want to share that we haven't talked about? You want to tell some Eric stories that he doesn't want told?
If I could come up with one.
No, we don't need to get him in trouble.
I can't think of anything off the top of my head, but.
And he probably would share it anyhow.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Anyway, I want to say thank you, Ian, for coming on board and sharing your history and what you've done in off-road. And, you know, the interesting things that you've done. I hope you success with the Go Devil Run and Big Willie's Jeep putting together the stuff for flat fenders. I think that's a great idea in market, especially right now with the interest everybody has in doing the resto mods, I guess you'd call it. I mean, just bringing them back to life, but, you know, not tearing them up. So,
yeah, I agree. Thank you. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. And I'll let you know when we're going to air this. And again, thank you very much for coming on board and spending the time.
Okay. I've got one question for you.
Sure.
Flour or corn tortilla?
Oh, corn tortilla.
All right. How about cilantro or lettuce?
Cilantro.
Perfect. You got a perfect score.
Just to let you know, we did a taco tour while we were down in Mexico for the thousand.
And oh, nice.
What we tried to do is in a 3-day period, we ate 17 different types of tacos.
Oh, awesome.
And there was only one. They said it was stingray, and I don't know what it really was, but it was the nastiest stuff I have ever tried to eat. And, and it wasn't, I don't think it was stingray unless it was the innards out of the stingray, but that was the only one I couldn't eat. The rest of them were just delicious as hell.
That's great.
All right.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Okay. And thank you. Talk to you later.
All right. We'll talk to you soon.
Right. Bye.
If you enjoy these podcasts, please give us a rating. Share some feedback with us via Facebook or Instagram, and share our link among your friends who might be like-minded. Well, that brings this episode to an end. Hope you enjoyed it. We'll catch you next week with Conversations with Big Rich. Thank you very much.